Hello and welcome to Firestarters, the UK's first podcast for social enterprise in health. I'm Dave Dawes and this is the final part of a five-part workshop on how to create a social enterprise. Well, pretty much if you haven't listened to the rest of it, it won't make very much sense, so I suggest you go back and listen to the previous four podcasts. You can find more details and we'll be running more courses at entrepreneurses.net, entreprenurses.net. And the thing about money is, it, like I said, I kind of treat it as it's manageable if you've got to deal with it. But at the end of the day, you don't want to live your whole life with money. Because A, it starts getting really pressured, and it's not the people you are. If you're all heavily financially motivated people, you probably will be accountants or in the stock market and the rest of it. So you need to have a grip of it and be aware of it, and particularly know about the impact of fear. Because people don't talk about, no one ever talked to about that. No one ever said, how do you go to a business and you're positive and you're going, yeah, this is great, and I don't quite know how the mortgage is going to get paid in precisely 8 days' time. And when you start knowing exactly what day the cheque is going to clear and exactly what day the amount of revenue is, and that's the stage you get to. But you've actually got to function, and you've got to inspire your team, and you've got to do the leadership, and you've got to get out there. And it's just, it's doable, it really is doable, and everyone's gone through it, but people often don't talk about it. They just talk about it as if, oh, well, businesses just do this and the money arrives and you become profitable and you grow and you're dead successful. Yeah, you do, but those early stages are actually quite hard. And that's probably where I said most of those businesses fail because of cash flow. It is that kind of thing. They get to a stage where they need money and they haven't got the capacity to pull it in, and then suddenly the bank pulls. And what happens is one debtor can't be paid and they take them to court. And if you can't pay them to court, they petition for bankruptcy and then ping. That's what happens. So. But it's kind of manageable and rideable through if you know what it is and you can plan in advance. And if you plan in advance, like me, you can have a business go bankrupt and end up with 95 grand personal debt and actually still have a house and still have a perfectly good living, so long as you plan and you get advice and you think, okay, here's the strategy and here's what we're going to do. So, okay? So very quickly, just before
that. Chief executive and
well, it could, you see, and then if it comes to that stuff, and maybe nurses get this.
Question.
I'm going to get nursing. How many people have you, and maybe palliative care was my thing, so you'd spend time with people who are dying, and they look back on their life and go, what have they done? And you said, yeah, you can. You can wander around and have a flashcard and go, ooh, I'm a chief executive, and I'm going to have an ego trip. And you can do some of this, and then at the end of the day, you'll probably do that till you're about 55. They reorganise you, pay you a pension, and you potter along, and you kind of think, is that kind of what I want to do with my life? Or is something what I want to do with my life actually about changing the world by making the world a better place? One of my passionate areas is I see people, I think, I'd love all of you to have huge, thrivingly successful social enterprises. That would give me a huge buzz. You know, I'm supporting developing people and probably having much more impact than I ever had as a chief exec. And you go, but there's a price for the lifestyle. And there's a bit that says, actually, if you could live your life the way you really want to do it, and you could do this amazing stuff, and you could really be living a dream. And so when someone look back and go, would you like life differently? You go, no. And you go, okay, there's kind of an entry fee, and there's a bit of risk, and there's a bit of fear. But it's manageable. It's manageable risk, it's manageable fear. You get some support and coaching. It is amazing stuff. And the ability to be able to see a gap and go, do you know, we're not doing that service very well. Look at the potential we could do with this service without having to go to a committee full of people and go, oh, that's very interesting, come back in 5 months and we might, well, we would, but, you know, the DARSI report, we're not going to fund that this year. Do you know what, I've decided I want to change your job and make you do this. Or you have the potential to go, do you know what, I've seen a gap, I'm going to do some stuff with it, we're going to do it. And actually, you then start making that change to the world, and that's amazing. And I just go, there's an entry fee, there's some stuff you're going to have to deal with for a while, but actually no, when I look back on it, I see people in those management jobs who are kind of stressed to the eyeballs, working bonkers hours. You know, I've had every half term with my son for the last 5 years, you know, and me and him negotiate if I'm going to be away. And if I turn around and say, do you know what, it's a lovely day today, we're going to go to the cinema and we're going to live that, you know, do that kind of life. And to impact the people I want to impact my life on. It's amazing. It is amazing. And the thing is, when people talk about bankruptcy, it's scarier than actually when you go through that. I've been 3 hours away from personal bankruptcy. And okay, those 3 hours were a bit like playing high stakes poker when your car's on the table and the house on the table and you've got two aces and you think, I hope to God he's not got the other two aces. But those moments are few and far between. And then I look at the people I go back to going, actually, you really affected my life. And now look at this amazing thing I'm doing because of what you did. You know, that's what you love. And that, but that's that thing that says, if you can take the risk and the fear and the uncertainty because you want to do this amazing thing, then that's great. For some people, the risk, the uncertainty, and the fear is too much, and they just can't do it. And they go, it's not the right life for you then. By all means, help people, by all means, develop people, but you're not actually going to be able to cope. It's just too scary for you. I don't know if that answers your...
It's a mixed economy as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is doable.
Work and, you know, the danger is you see things as absolutes.
Yeah.
That's cutting off a lot of your options. And scale, what point you enter, can have a big difference to...
I think there's such flexible working out by now.
Yes.
It's never been so open in terms of the health economy, I mean health and social economy, I've never been so open to the idea of entrepreneurship in every form, not just in terms of this business idea, you know, business money making idea, because of the way you've got sort of the imagination and the way commissions changing and happening is being developed.
There's a lot of potential. It's an area where you could do it. But what I want people to do, and what I hope you take from today, is saying, let's have a bit of a reality check, but let's not let the whole thing down so much that it terrifies us. But some people it will. That's just a human reaction. They look at the risk and the fear of failure, and that is so overwhelming it paralyzes people. And they want to do enterprise in a risk-free way, and they go, that's just not the way it works. And entrepreneurship is inherently risky, but those risks are manageable, but the benefits are amazing, and it's just that trade-off. You know. I just want to very quickly do marketing, just because a lot of people, when they talk about marketing, talk about PR and advertising, and that's not really... I don't know if people have seen this. This is the curve from... books like The Tipping Point talk about it. It's the change and innovation curve. And the idea is, and there's a lot of evidence behind it, that the population is split into five groups of people. There's innovators, who make up about 2.5% of the population. Then there's early adopters, about 10%. The early majority, it's about 37%. The late majority, about 37%. And the laggards, about 12.5%. Now, let me work through a couple of examples. Let's take mobile phones. How many people in the room have got a mobile phone? Okay, probably everyone. If I'd asked that question 20 years ago, there would probably be maybe one or two, maybe in a big briefcase and have a battery life about 3/4 of an hour. But there were people with a mobile phone then. So if you take mobile phones, what starts happening is a few people go, hey, have you seen this big brick that I can make a phone call outside and the battery lasts 35 minutes? And you go, okay. But they love it. It's new. It's funky. It's like, oh, I like new stuff. They're a bit strange, though. People don't take them generally seriously. What your early adopters do is they know innovators. They're friends of innovators. And they go, what's that big brick you're carrying around? They go, oh, it's a mobile phone, have a go. And they go, yeah, actually, this sort of works. Not a bad idea. It's a bit better than that, you know, edible sandals you were wearing last week. I don't know what that was about, and that bizarre car. And you know, but actually, yeah, it's a mobile phone idea. It's one of your more sensible ones. So they start going, yeah, we're looking at the innovators and all their wacky stuff, and some of this stuff works. Then what happens is gradually the early majority says, you know, we're starting to see people with mobile phones around. And actually, then gradually what happens is the percentage of people with one moves and moves. And there will always be some people without. Even now, there are some people who don't have a mobile phone, but they're very much in the minority. It's like people without a telephone. And it was the same when electricity was introduced. It's the same when computers were introduced. It's the same when, I don't know, SUVs were introduced. Yeah, anything you do has this curve. And what's interesting is there's a lot of evidence on how you move from each bit. So if you've got an idea for a service and it's never been done anywhere before, the people who will try it for the first time are innovators. So if there are commissioners, who will take a punt on a new type of service that's a bit untried, it's a bit untested, it's a bit wacky, but and you probably know people like that. They make decisions, they'll try new stuff, because what's really important for them is they want to be right ahead of the curve, they want to be the first purpose, they love innovation, they love newness, they love that passion. Then you'll have the early adopters who are kind of interested in it, but a bit more sensible. They like being ahead of the curve, but they don't want to buy something stupid. So for them, they need a safety curve. So innovator, you could go, I've got a great idea. What if we did Meals on Wheels, right? And what we did is we got a gun and we put kebabs in and we fired kebabs through letterboxes. There are people that go, yeah, okay, let's give it a pump. And there'll be other people go, I want to see it working first. Have you got evidence? Yeah, we did this kebab thing, right, in this village, and we fired kebabs through the shops, and actually people quite liked it. Okay, I'll give that a go. It's a bit weird, it's a bit new, but it's been tested somewhere. Gradually, when these people are using it, then the early majority go, do you know, I'm reading about this kebab firing thing, and it seems to be taking off. And they're doing it in London and Sheffield and Newcastle. And actually, I saw someone at a conference talking about it, and I saw a paper being written about it. And now I'm kind of, I'm a bit mainstream, but it sounds interesting. It sounds like it's sort of a new thing. It's being tried, it's tested. We'll take it. And gradually it moves through here. These people are dead suspicious. I won't do it until most people are doing it. But I don't want to be left out. I don't want to be the last person with a mobile phone in the room. But once most people I know have got a mobile phone, I'll have that. And then there's some people that go, stupid idea, kebabs, and I don't really care. Quite frankly, electricity is overrated. That kind of thing. So does that make sense in terms of, and anything, literally anything works through this. And what I say to people is the use for you when you're developing a new idea is if your idea is very new, you're at this stage. So what you need to do is you need to find people who are interested in the new idea, and by and large, they will have to know you. So what happens here is this is through your personal contacts and networks. So if you've got an idea, say for a nursing home service, you think, okay, who are the people I know who might be up for something a bit new and innovative? So you go to them and you say, I want to pilot this. Can we pilot it and see if it works? These people probably say yes. You pilot it in a couple of areas, then you take it to some of these people who are known by them, and they go, it works, let me show you, let me present at conferences. So the first people you're basically selling to are people you know, or people that you know of, or people you can put in touch with. So it's not like a pyramid selling you kind of thing, but just you wouldn't send out a mass letter to every PCT in the country going, I've got this new idea, who's interested? Because what happens is the vast majority of these go, it's new, I'm not touching new with a 20-foot barge pole. So it's
buying into you, not the problem. Yeah. That's the trust is that you make things work. And
yeah.
And as you're going through, that changes. See, the other thing is you might present the same product differently to these various groups. So the way you frame the product. So it might be a new nursing home, but it's basically a nursing home with a bit of a difference. So you build trust around the bit that's proven, established, and then this new bit just adds value further. Yeah. Some people like things that are different, some people like the same. But they'll have a core need that needs to be met. So you prove the core need is already a proof, you know, it's principle proven. So even though there's like, you know, it's danger with any model is you see things in absolute terms. In reality, things nothing is ever totally new. There's an element of it which has, you know, is a proven. Even in another industry, you can show people to give them, help them manage the risk of investing in you using their provision. But it's focused, it's knowing profiling these and knowing who falls into what group. I suppose the trick is knowing your market. What would be the indicators of someone who's an innovator in terms of a commissioner versus someone who's a laggard? Yeah.
The answer,
you know, is how you work that out.
I totally agree with Sam. One of the things is diagnosing where you are. And this is very simple. What percentage of those people are using it? So if you take something like hospices, hospices are about here. Not every PCT in the country is funding a hospice. But actually about 90% are. If you took something like eating disorder services that are actually based out in the community, I think you're probably about there. So there's an issue that says, depending on where you are, your issue then is how do you move between the stages? And there's a lot of literature on, and once you know where you are, where your next stage to get to. So if you're at an innovator stage, the way you get to early adopters is through their connections with innovators. So you're still at the personal connection, it's about you. Once you're going from here to here, then you start to get into mass media and advertising. But what people often go wrong, in fact, I'm working with an organisation, Salford, they're trying to do mass media and advertising on an untested product. They want to send a flyer with a bit of an idea that's never been tested to, you know, every PCT in the country. And you go, that's not going to work, because for most people, an untested idea is why on earth would I touch it? So what sometimes happens is because people think marketing is PR advertising, mass leaflets, mass mail, we do. In year one, we sent all these things out to every director of nursing in the country, all these chief execs, we paid a small fortune, we had glossy brochures, we sent it out for a very new untested idea. And actually 95% of them didn't touch it with a barge pole. People that did were people we were kind of vaguely in contact with anyway. So what I would say is if it's the early stages, then it's through personal networks and just that, you know, what's appropriate here is not appropriate here. So you don't get into mass media, advertising, big PR campaigns, you know, cold calling, all the rest of it, until you're in this territory. That makes sense? So if you've got a new idea, we go back to that, you're in full time, you're in an organisation, but you've got a cool idea, who are the people that might be up for it? And actually start that dialogue now. And they might go, I'm really up for it. And I might even fund you for the first 6 months because it's such a cool idea. Yeah.
You know, like in PCT's commissioning and providings, dividing down. Would it be fair to say, you know, something I kind of have a vague notion is that I kind of have to be careful who I talk to because you might be treading on their corns if they're a provider. If someone's in the provider arm and you start saying, what do you think about this cool idea, I want to be a social entrepreneur, and they're dependent on funding from the commissioner for providing services.
So you're talking about a competitor.
Yeah, you're working for your competitor. But if you see what I mean.
But that's an interesting...
You're currently working for your competitor.
A potential competitor.
That sort of language.
But where people... I think you're right, but I think it's a perception thing. I've heard this a lot where people go, well, I work for a PCT and I'm going to be a competitor. And I went, No.
Right.
You might be a competitor for the manager that provides services. You are not a competitor for the commissioner. Now, if the commissioner and the provider services are sleeping together, you might have a problem. But most of the time, the commissioner says, that's a cool idea. And if you can show what's wrong with the provider, then you can say, well, you and I know that. I don't know, we do this Meals on Wheels service, and 50% of people throw it in the bin, and everyone hates it. And we could do it much better. I've got this idea, are you interested? And I can demonstrate it, then they might be up for it. So there's sometimes a perception. I said the people that pay the money are usually not the people running the services, even though they might be in the same building. Yeah.
But I suppose my question actually is, are the commissioners sleeping with the providers?
Some are, some aren't. And the other thing is, people tend to imagine that there is only, you know, the one PCT. This here is a little map of, this is Yorkshire and Humber one. I have these for all of them. This is in Yorkshire and Humber. Here's a list of all the PCTs. And what you find is a whole bunch of them. And quite a lot of them are neighbouring. So it might be that one PCT says, not interested. But if you've got contacts with someone nearby and you go, well, it's only 10 miles up the road, I could deliver a service there, then they might be up for it. Or you might say, actually, I could geographically spread around a bit. So you find someone who's up for the idea. And I think it depends. If they're an innovator, but you go, I've done my planning and I've done my research, I'm building up the relationships, I'm having a dialogue, I'm going to do something different. It's still a bit risky, but it's not a huge amount of money. I've kept the cost down. Would you, you know, you can normally get 15 grand out of a public sector commissioner with a reasonably good idea. And if you can run it for 6 months on 15 grand, then I say there's quite a lot of people who can authorise that level of expenditure. If you're going to need $250,000 to start up, then it's going to be a longer process. But if you can start small and prove concept, even if you just go, we did it in this village or in this town, and look at the response we got. What if we scaled it up a bit? Then it's much easier for them as well to present to their bosses. We're scaling it up. But you know what? This isn't an innovative, wacky idea. We've already done it somewhere. We just want to spread it out a bit.
Just need to be a little bit careful around if you're working for an employer and whilst in their employment and during their time, planning your escape.
You have to be careful.
Developing those things. Oh. That employer is well within their right to suspend and dismiss you. Stealing their time. There are big conflicts of interest. And if you are tainted by that, that commissioner will go near you like a barge pole, because organisationally, even though they are separate parts of the organisation, there's a breach of trust. Everything you do in terms of the relationships you develop, whether it be business, partnerships, whether it be about getting people to give you money, is based on your ability to get them to trust you and buy into you as a person. And the way you discharge yourself will be judged and viewed by others. So if you can be on the up and up with people in terms of your what you're doing and why you're trying to do it and those sorts of things, and you're clear about the boundaries and time, you'll be easier yourself in terms of what you can go forward. But I am aware of cases where people have been dismissed in these circumstances.
I've had the conversation.
Yeah.
So be sensible, because you may need to keep that job you've got now. You know, don't put your boat out for you.
Commissioners, because it's so new, still want to stay with the providers that they're used to.
You see,
unless the providers are really, really poor, that's
you see, actually, that's a bit of an urban myth. I know why it looks that way, but the strategic health authorities are pressurising them to dump the provider. And if a PCT hasn't got plans at the moment to dump its provider, the strategic health authorities are putting pressure on them to say, even if you float it to Community Foundation Trust or a social enterprise or that, we want to see that gone. And the government's been very clear, they do not expect PCTs to be provided in a few years' time. And so although at a certain level in the organisation it looks like that, I go to meetings nationally and the room is packed with PCTs saying, how does the social enterprise model work? How does the community foundation model work? How does this work? Because the push from the government is separate purchase and provision. So what I'm saying is you might be getting a lot of messages, and there may be very close relationships between the commissioner and the provider. And what that might mean is where you are now is scorched earth. And like Simon says, if you can leave in an open, honest, transparent, that's absolutely ideal. Very occasionally, and it's a very high-risk strategy, you won't be able to. So sometimes you have to say, it's not going to work here, and you accept the fact that you're probably not going to get commissioned there, but you need to move, say, to the neighbouring PCT. Because PCTs are often quite competitive anyway. And if you say, look, I used to work in this service, I've come up with a better idea, I've got this idea, I want to run it past you and develop it, you know, you can do it. It's much, much better if your manager goes, yeah, I'm up for it. And particularly if you say to him, well, you know, look at Darcy, look at SHA guys, actually, this isn't as threatening, because actually we can improve the service, we can do this. It's kind of trying to sell it to people, get people on board with it if you can.
It's not a business decision. People often make decisions on an emotional basis.
Yeah.
And it's really not hard to come up with a reason not to give you money. You package it in a way that it's vague. But so if someone wanted to stop you getting any business from them, that's the easiest thing in the world for them to do. It would be very hard to challenge it, unless it was absolutely extreme, you know, in terms of the match between it. And particularly if you're an untested provider and they're a bit risk averse. So you need that goodwill, because some of your credibility will come from where you're working now, won't it, in terms of your position within the market. Because you'll have a period where you've got experience in terms of working in an organisation, where you've delivered results and you've achieved the outcomes. And you'd be trying to link people, to link that success to you as a person of getting things done, to your new organisation. It'd be really good for people to be able to write to them for a reference, or speak to them, or bump into them at a conference or whatever, to reinforce that view. But we all sometimes have bosses who are arses, don't we? So, well, that might be the reason you're trying to do what you're doing, is because so it's how you navigate that.
I mean,
it can be challenging, can't it?
I agree with Simon, and it is by far the ideal, and a lot of people don't work at that. And I often say to people, if your boss can support you, your life will be so much easier. If your organisation supports you, your life will be so much easier. They might even provide money, they might even second you, they might even say, we'll pay a salary. They can solve so many of your problems, they might help you with commissioners, but sometimes it's not going to happen. It shouldn't stop an entrepreneur if that happens. It's worth such a lot. It's worth putting a lot of time and effort into it and trying to build those relationships. But sometimes it doesn't. And in fact, if you look at the private sector, a lot of companies that are rivals have started by someone leaving, setting up, and there is bad blood initially. And then gradually they get to, you look at stuff like Apple and Microsoft and Google, and a lot of those companies end up at each other's throats, often from ex-employees leaving to go and do their own. But it's a challenging issue, and it is hard. And like Simon says, they can cause some bad blood if you're not careful.
You might have competition agreements with the contract of employment as well. but bars you from working for a similar organisation for a period of time.
A lot of the big consultancies, if you work for someone like, you know, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Accenture, they will have a clause that says you can't work with any of our clients for so many years. Sometimes you get things like that. But the other side of the fence, in terms of people saying they don't want competitors, is go back to when catering and cleaning was taken out of NHS Trust. You know, those staff were really well loved by those organisations, and it was forced on them. They didn't want to go out, but they had to. They didn't want to award the tender to private companies, but they actually had to. And I think the provider side is gonna happen more and more in terms of saying you're gonna have to get rid of it. And if you've got people within it says I've got an exit strategy already, and it's presented in a positive way that helps their boss look good. Because if you can make your boss look good and the director look good and the organisation look good, they might be able to put some money behind you and say, do you know what, we might even help you. When I left the leadership centre, the head at the time was really nice. She said, do you know what, when you work in the notice, you can set up a new company. Do you want some training? Have you ever done any of this work? We'll give you some training. Because she saw it as a really positive thing. And that made such a difference. She was proud that she was able to say, I've given birth to this enterprise that's floated off. Because it made her look good. So it's almost how you turn it from saying, look, don't think of us as competitors if you can get away with it. Think of us as a great success story that you can say to other people, look how innovative we are. Look at this cool service we've created. But, you know, easier said than done. But
there's not that many of those sorts, is there?
But it's sometimes about the final idea
of sorts who kind of have that developmental attitude to the people that work in their organisation.
If they are, the interesting thing, just before we break for lunch, and it goes back to how you sell this stuff, is if you sell the outcome, so if what you say is, look, rather than talk about the process of what I'm going to deliver, I'm going to talk about the outcome. I can deliver this outcome for this group of people for this amount of money. People like it. If that outcome is something they're being performance managed, and you say, I can help you deliver the outcome you want to your board, then again, that's something that's very, very easy to sell. You know, because what you can say to someone is, look, you've got a waiting list problem. I could help you solve that waiting list problem. I could help you solve that waiting list problem by maybe actually creating a little service. And do you know, social enterprises are sexy enough at the moment that you might get funding from the social enterprise fund or whatever. It's seen as an okay thing to do. And people have been leaving the NHS to set up businesses for years, and sometimes it's been a hard struggle. At the moment, it's kind of a nice space to say, yeah, we want it to happen. Or if you're outside the NHS, commissioners have been pressurised, say, are you funding social enterprises? Are you commissioning with them? So it's kind of an easier time than... Is there any... I mean, we're about to break for lunch. Any burning questions? Because I'm going to go in about half an hour, and Simon's going to take you through kind of the next steps and making this real. Anything burning? I mean, you've all got my email address and telephone anyway. I'm really, really sorry I couldn't be here, or I really wanted to be here all day, but we were talking about startup funding. I'm actually up for an unlimited level 2 award. So this afternoon, someone might decide to give me £18,000. So much as I love and adore you, and much as I want this to be a success, spoken like a true entrepreneur, he said, I'll let you go for £9,000. if you can whip up £2,000 each, I'll see. Just quickly before, because what I want to do is just very quickly talk. If everyone wants to come over here, I'll just quickly show you through these books and resources. So, and I'll be around for lunch. And then we'll... Okay. Some of the really useful books and some stuff that you will... this is probably the book collection I would probably use. Certainly a subset of it set up. This is the best entrepreneur book there is. The Beer Mat Entrepreneur by Mike Southern and Chris West is a really good startup from what's your idea, how do you grow it in the early stages, how do you get it through the middle stages. It's nice, it's readable, you can do it in an afternoon. It's a nice book. There's also one called The Entrepreneur's Book of Checklists, which I haven't got, which is similar. They're good all-round starting books for starting up businesses.
Is there a copy of this book list on your website?
Do you know what? I might type this up. Yeah,
great.
That's a good idea, actually. Okay, the next one is this. This is £5 from the Social Enterprise Coalition. Unlocking the Potential, a Guide to Finance for Social Enterprises.
That was on the website. You can download it.
You sure you can download it for free?
Well, when they first put it out.
I saw it.
They should. I lend people
quite a long
bootleg copies.
Yeah, I've got some. Yeah, yeah.
talks you through a lot of the funding sources, which is dead good. And the CDFA Finding Finance, but I think there's an updated one of this actually. But again, this lists, like, here are places you go to. Very, very useful books, actually. Probably the most useful finance books. Health Guide to Health and Social Enterprise and Health and Social Care. It's all right. It gives you some examples of what other people have done. I have a free to look through. Now, we get on some interesting ones. This is about tendering for public sector contracts. Now, a lot of you at the startup stage will struggle to tender for a bunch of reasons, but it talks you through the mechanics of what the procurement processes work, sizes of money. So, for instance, in a nutshell, if you want up to 15 grand, there's probably 30 or 40 people in a PC2 who could authorise that personally.
If you want, dead.
Oh, yeah. If you want up to 50 grand, there's probably going to have to be a tender process. If it goes above that, Europe gets involved. And so, and this kind of talks you through it, how you do it, how you bid. It's a good book. Good book. This is quite nice. This is a business planning process for developing social enterprises. Now, it's a little bit too much detail, I think, but it's not a bad thing to flick through.
Yeah, I use that with groups.
I dip into it. Yeah. It's quite good. Now, some weird and wonderful ones, which a lot of people haven't come across. The Jelly Effect by Andy Bounds, the definitive book on how to network and pitch an idea presentation. I relentlessly use this, and in fact, I must talk to Andy about maybe doing some joint stuff. But it is fantastic. Once you've read this book, and you try some, they work in practice, and you see people, and you go, "Oh wow, yeah, it works." I actually used some of the principles in this on Sunday to help someone work on their pitch, and they got $5,000 from a presentation, essentially using some of this stuff. Now, this is a peculiar one because it's a consulting book, Getting Started in Consulting by Alan Weiss. Now, the interesting bit is pages, about chapter 7, no, it's not chapter 7, it's back a bit. It's about the kind of later half, because the first half, unless you particularly want to be a consultant, isn't that useful. But what he has is an interesting model, which is kind of in the latter half, about how you sell outcomes. Now, one of the things I used to do in the early days, I would sell process. So in other words, someone says, "What can you do for us?" And you go, "Well, we could run this day centre, we'd have so many hours, we'd have so many employees." You describe the process of what you do. And what people try and do is they nail you down, cut your costs, do less time, do it smaller. What he says, you totally turn it on its head, you sell outcomes. You go, "Here's the change I'm going to make in this group of people. How I do it, it actually doesn't really matter. But I'm going to sell an outcome and it's worth this." I'm not doing it justice. It needs working through. But when I started doing this, I had much, much better success in selling projects and ideas. So a guy called Alan Weiss has also written Million Dollar Consulting, which essentially is the same model. This is a very surreal book, and half of it is rubbish. But there's some stuff in here about how you make the transition from full-time staff to part-time staff to running your own business, which is interesting. And he also talks about maybe using the web to make some income for your social enterprise, which is some useful ideas. And in fact, one of the things we're testing with this, the idea of actually let's capture this content. Let's see if we can do something interesting with the content on the web. And let's actually see if somehow this can stimulate income streams. We're trying a number of things. But if by the end of the year this works and we're able to say to other people, here's how you do it, you know, capture your content. And finally, this is a really good book from Rosemary Cook, Director of the Queen's Nursing Institute, about awareness and influence in health and social care. There's a lot there about reputations, influencing skills, building credibility. It's really good stuff, but it is quite important because, as Simon said, a lot of people often, because entrepreneurs are often a bit prickly and they sometimes rub people up the wrong way and they sometimes come across a bit arrogant, it's quite easy to get a bit of a bad reputation. And I have a dreadful reputation in some of the places I've worked. This is a good thing about actually how do you actually manage your reputation, how people think of you, how you're able to influence a network. It's nice. It comes from a really nice, ethically grounded place as well, which is nice. So, let's get some lunch.
Thank you.
And that was the end of the workshop on creating a social enterprise. My name's been Dave Dawes. This has been brought to you by entrepreneurses.net, entreprenurses.net. We will be running subsequent courses, and you can find more details on the website. The music is by DJ Booley, under a Creative Commons license.
And I really hope you're enjoying these podcasts. We'd love to hear your feedback and any comments and suggestions for future ones.